Okay. All right, so in this lecture today, I want to kind of give you an overview of what ecosystem ecology is and how it came to be. And in particular, introduce how it might be a useful approach to addressing issues of global change. And I'll hand out the case study assignment for this unit right now, because we'll get into that in a second. Can you pass this down there? I'll come around that side. Hey. Anybody not get one? If you lose it, it can be downloaded from the class website. Okay, so let's start with some definitions of ecology. You've been in this class for a semester. What's a definition for ecology? If you can read your downloaded notes. You can tell me the answer. So the study of interactions among organisms and their environment. And some would argue that the ecosystem is the fundamental unit of ecology. So an ecosystem is a spatially explicit place that includes all of the organisms along with all of the abiotic components of that place within its boundaries. So if we think about how we've approached the study of ecology in this class, first we started with physiological ecology, which looked at the abiotic environment as some set of forces that affected the organism's physiology that led to changes in its ability to grow, survive, and reproduce. So here we have one organism, and it's being constrained by the environment. When we started to think about populations, all we did is we said, okay, we have multiple individuals that are growing and reproducing and surviving. These are the same species. But the environment in this case is constraining, in particular, the reproductive capacity of the population, its survival in time. So how about when we consider communities of organisms? Well, we might have different species. Here's another species. Here's another one. In this case, the abiotic environment is still constraining growth and survival and reproduction, but also interactions between these species become important and affect the growth of populations. Evan?
So other organisms are considered part of a single organism's environment?
So other organisms are, if they're interacting, yeah, they're in the same environment. So now we come to ecosystems where we have a slightly different perspective. We have all these different organisms. And we have the abiotic factors. But now we're going to consider them as one system that have feedbacks on each other. So the organisms feed back to the abiotic environment, and the abiotic environment feeds back to the biota. And ecosystem ecologists then study these kinds of interactions between the abiotic and the biotic. We'll get to that more in this slide. So what we do is we study what we call the structural aspects of ecosystems and the functional aspects of ecosystems. So what we want to know is what regulates the amount of materials in this ecosystem. And by materials, we mean things like how much carbon is there in the ecosystem, and how fast is it moving around, either between the organisms or from the organisms to the atmosphere. And so some examples of things that are structural are, what organisms are there? Oops, let's turn that off. Their identity, the species that are there, what's their abundance? What's their biomass? How much nitrogen and phosphorus is in those organisms? Nutrient levels. Or how much nutrients are available in the soil or in the water. And then functional aspects are going to be processes that change the structure. Processes like metabolism, which you're probably familiar with as aerobic respiration or photosynthesis. So those are processes that change the concentrations of carbon, say, in the atmosphere. And processes like decomposition that transform nutrients from, say, biomass or leaf material to plant-available nutrients. And we'll get into this in more detail later. One assumption in ecosystem ecology is that the size and the boundary of the ecosystem are set by the scientist who's studying them. So, for example, there are ecosystem ecology papers that deal with the biofilms that live on your teeth and the processes that go on between the microbes and the teeth can be studied as an ecosystem. You can have all sorts of different scales. On this graph, we have the endolithic system, which are the lichens that live on rocks and are responsible for mineralizing the rocks. Or you can have a forest ecosystem on the scale of a kilometer. Or you can study the whole globe as an ecosystem. And so in this unit, we'll have examples that are at different scales. And the reasons for that are to make it easier to measure what's going on. So now what I want to do is give you a brief history of the ecosystem concept. We've talked to some extent about part of these ideas, trophic interactions, so food web kinds of interactions were an important foundation. Succession is something that we haven't talked about yet, but we will later on in this unit. And succession is the change in species over time after a disturbance. And then biogeochemistry is the study of processes that regulate fluxes of nutrients. And the person that synthesized these three ideas was a scientist named Raymond Lindemann in 1942. So for succession, his ideas were coming from plant ecology, where plant ecologists were studying how plant communities changed over time. And this guy, Henry Chandler Coles, was studying plant grass communities on sand dunes near Lake Michigan where wind was a disturbance that would wipe out the grass communities. And so he'd watch how they changed over time. And so they're changing in response to this wind stress. And he thought that succession was pretty much an orderly sequence. It started out with kind of a weedy species of grasses that would come in and then more long-lived perennial grasses. So he thought that it was an orderly sequence. Frederick Clements is a guy that I mentioned before who was also studying plant succession. And he said that he took Cowell's idea even farther and said, yeah, it's extremely regular and orderly. And the end community that results is a climax community, or one that's easily predicted from the environment. So you would say, like, the deciduous maple, oak maple forest on the East Coast is a climax community. It's not going to go beyond that unless it gets wiped out by a fire. And this guy was criticized in ecology and kind of outcast because he took this idea of the community to an extreme and said that these plant communities were like a superorganism that evolved together. And so he was criticized because he said that the whole community can co-evolve. And what do you know about natural selection? Why would he be criticized? You think it acts on the individual, and so he was kind of made fun of because he said that the community is not an organism. Gleason is another guy that I mentioned previously. He was a British guy, and he was the guy that said that communities are there because of their individual physiological constraints and how they're dealing with the environment. So if you remember the kind of sample graph that I drew, they all have these individual tolerance curves. And if this is the area where you're sampling, you'll have these three species here, but it's just chance that they're there together. They're together because they're responding to their abiotic constraints. And so he said that what you have at a community is a result of dispersion or dispersal and selection, not because they're all evolving together. So this actually created a big rift in ecology, and in order to kind of come to terms with this debate, this British scientist, Tansley, coined the term ecosystem to kind of get around this idea of the community being there by chance or whether they were there because they were evolving together. So he said that the ecosystem includes not only these organisms, but the whole complex of physical factors that form the environment. So that's how the term ecosystem came about. It came about because of a debate in ecology about what a community was. So now let's look at trophic interactions. This is an old guy who was studying lakes and studying the animal communities in lakes and was interested in the predatory and competitive relationships in lakes. And so he said that within the boundary of a lake, you can understand a lot about how it works by looking at their feeding relationships. So that's the idea that you can study one system, a lake. Charles Elton is one of the people that I talked about in terms of what a niche is. And he described niches as a role that's defined by who eats who. And he came up with the idea of food chain and this idea of pyramid of numbers, where here's a simple food chain that has a primary producer, phytoplankton, an herbivore, and then some kind of carnivore. And what he recognized was that there are a lot more individuals at this lowest food trophic level compared to the top trophic level, and thought that the reason for that had to do with the transfer of energy from each trophic level, but he didn't quantify that energy loss. But Raymond Lindeman did. Biogeochemistry actually is a field that came from Russia. And Vladimir Vernadsky was a soil scientist who was basically studying decomposition in soil and described the movement of minerals from the soil into the vegetation and then decomposition, allowing those to go back again. And G. Evelyn Hutchinson, who is a scientist that has been mentioned a lot in this class, learned about his work and brought it to the United States. And so what he did is he just basically said, hey, check out all this kind of cool stuff. Elton's pyramid of numbers could be studied in terms of, say, carbon transfer from one level to another. And he thought that these things would be related to each other. And this is G. Evelyn Hutchinson's family tree, so to speak, of scientists that are practicing today in the field of ecology. So there's a lot of them. So you can see he was a really important scientist. So G. Evelyn Hutchinson was a collaborator of this guy, Raymond Lindeman. And in Raymond Lindeman's dissertation work, he was studying the feeding relationships in a bog, a little pond in Minnesota, and he examined succession in the sense that over time, ponds and lakes get filled in with sediment and eventually become a terrestrial environment. So he talked about his work in that context. He studied the trophic interactions in Cedar Bog Lake for 5 years, and in addition to figuring out the diet contents of the members of the aquatic community, he calculated how much energy and matter, in terms of carbon, were transferred through these trophic relationships. And he determined that feeding relationships are not efficient with respect to energy. And so energy is lost in feeding relationships. And like I said, he was collaborating with Hutchinson. And Raymond Lindeman, so he was working on his PhD, he was like 27 or something when he wrote that paper, and it got rejected because of a debate between these two scientists. This is Hutchinson, and that is a guy named Chauncey Judae. And Raymond Lindeman died right after he submitted his paper to be published. And he had some type of congenital disease, and when he was working on his dissertation work, he would have to go collect all these bugs and stuff out of this lake and spend hours and hours and hours looking at them under a microscope and dissecting their guts to figure out what they're eating. And this process is really laborious. And he would work until he started to vomit up blood. And then he eventually just, you know, passed away because he just worked too hard. But Hutchinson was really persistent in terms of getting this paper published. And these two guys had a fight. Judae didn't like the paper because it was studying only one lake. And Lindeman thought that there were some good hypotheses that could be tested. So basically, to summarize their argument, this guy says, you guys analyze a lake by dipping your finger in it and telling a story. And this guy doesn't like his science. He says, your team is capable of making 10,000 measurements without having a single idea. And that's literally a response to the review from the paper that came out. But eventually it got published, and it's one of the more important papers in ecology. After the 1940s, after World War II, this field of ecology benefited from the atomic energy, what's the AEC stand for, Atomic Energy Commission? They had a lot of money left over after World War II, and they wanted to find friendly ways of using atomic energy instead of bombing people with it. And these two guys, Eugene and Howard Odum, were brothers, and they capitalized on that. And so they saw this huge amount of money that was available to do science, and they trained a lot of scientists that were trying to understand the effects of radiation on the environment. They studied things like biomagnification of radioactive contaminants. They measured metabolism of whole ecosystems, so photosynthesis and respiration in whole ecosystems. They used what's called systems analysis. Howard was originally trained as an engineer, I think. And so they would kind of conceive of ecosystems as black boxes of organisms. So here is a set of organisms that's doing something, like, let's say they're herbivores. And then they would draw all these kinds of funky diagrams that represented various sorts of energy transfer. Here's a resistor, and so there's some type of resistance to energy flow and stuff like that. So it's kind of funky. And they kind of conceived of ecosystems as electrical circuit diagrams, which is kind of weird. And they liked this idea of ecosystems as being kind of a functioning organism of its own. After the atomic energy money ran out, an international program was started that Utah State was actually part of in the 1960s that was called the International Biological Program. And their goal was to figure out, so in the 1960s, an issue that was becoming more apparent is population growth of humans. And a global challenge to understand, how are we going to feed all these people? And so that's kind of the reasoning behind this program being started. They wanted to quantify how much primary productivity there that was going on across different biomes. And so Utah State was in charge of the Great Basin Desert biome. They went around and measured productivity of sagebrush steppe and stuff like that. Because this program was so big, it started this kind of idea of doing science in big teams and not just as a single investigator. And they used some of these models, these kinds of circuit model things in their data analysis. Another type of what would be big ecology in terms of big money ecology is this study at Hubbard Brook, which is in New Hampshire. It's been ongoing now since the late 1950s. But these two guys, Gene Likens and Howard Borman, did ecosystem scale experiments to understand how forested watersheds worked. So they would do things like clear cut a whole watershed and then measure the nutrient losses from that. Because they've been monitoring this site for so long, Gene Likens has been responsible in some part for bringing data available to address issues of acid precipitation. And his work has contributed to the Clean Air Act. So changes in policy in response to these data that have been collected. Other influences of how ecosystems work come from Hans Jenny's state factors, which we mentioned in the very beginning of the class in terms of how soils work. Those are climate, parent material, topography, the biota, and time. So just to summarize then, this approach of studying ecosystems, you have to consider what the boundaries are You have to define your boundaries. What's in the ecosystem? What are the components? And then study how they're connected and work to make properties that you wouldn't necessarily measure if you're just studying a single organism. So some of what's going on now in ecosystem ecology, we have a pretty good understanding of what controls primary productivity. And a lot of technology available to study feedbacks between organisms and the abiotic environment. And understand why aquatic ecosystems become overly productive. That's eutrophication. So we know if we add a bunch of nutrients to a lake, you'll get an algal bloom, for example. What we don't have a good handle on is what the role of these species are in some of the types of studies that have been done. So we don't have a good sense of which interactions are important, what species are responsible for the things that we're measuring. So organisms can't be black boxed. We don't have a good handle on heterogeneity, so how patches of different resources and stuff like that might play into what we're measuring. And what's really big right now is understanding humans as part of ecosystems. So there's a bunch of people that are studying cities as ecological systems, incorporating the services that ecosystems provide, like clean air and clean water and nutrient productive soils. How do you quantify that in terms of economic value? So that's another area of research. And we have these issues of global change. In this class, we'll talk about a couple of issues of global change. One of these is nitrogen. So nitrogen, where do you think most of the nitrogen is on the planet? It's in the air, right? As nitrogen gas. And chemically, what this is a nitrogen with a triple bond to another nitrogen. And so because this bond is so strong, nitrogen gas is not very biologically available. So there's this great amount of nitrogen in the atmosphere, but it's not really accessible to most organisms. There are bacteria that can break this bond. So plants that have mutualisms with those bacteria can fix nitrogen. So nitrogen fixation is taking nitrogen gas and incorporating it into the biota. So in nitrogen poor environments, plants that have mutualistic relationships have an advantage in that they can fix nitrogen. So examples of plants that do that are legumes. Soybean is a crop that is a nitrogen-fixing crop. Alfalfa is a nitrogen-fixing crop. Alder is a tree that fixes nitrogen. But what's gone on in terms of global change is what we call anthropogenic nitrogen fixation or human nitrogen fixation. And humans fix nitrogen in a couple of different ways. One is by converting native plants communities to soybean, where we get this kind of fixation. But the primary way that we fix atmospheric nitrogen is through the production of fertilizers, where we take nitrogen gas and combine it with hydrogen in a factory setting, and then you can make ammonium fertilizer, so a salt. And then last of all, in combustion of fossil fuels, some oxides of nitrogen, like nitrate, are formed, and those can be carried in precipitation and when that precipitation falls to the ground, it acts as a fertilizing effect. So what has happened over the last 50 years is the rate of anthropogenic or human nitrogen fixation is equal to or exceeding the natural background level of nitrogen fixation. So what that does is it basically is adding nitrogen to the biosphere, doubling the amount of nitrogen that's available for the biota. You had a question?
Did I understand that right? Driving cars can add nitrogen to the soil from this?
Yeah, we'll talk more about that when we talk about nitrogen cycle. But through combustion, just any kind of forest fire, any kind of combustion, when you have that that high energy, you can react nitrogen gas into oxides. And then as we talked about in the beginning of the class, the global carbon cycle has been influenced by, at a global scale, through combustion of fossil fuels, where the carbon dioxide concentration has gone up about 60 parts per billion. Yeah.
So what is nitrogen then considered a limiting
nutrient? In most terrestrial environments, the thought is that nitrogen is a limiting nutrient. In areas, so if I draw, here's the U.S., here's Texas and Florida, okay? Here's the Great Lakes. In this region of the U.S., there's evidence that the terrestrial communities are becoming saturated with nitrogen. So there's so much nitrogen available to them that the plants just can't take up anymore.
Does that play into the theory that if we then give them the limiting nutrients that they needed, that other plants will have more competition, you eventually get less speciation?
Less diversity? Yeah, I mean, in some parts of the country, that they're associated with this extra nitrogen. In the Northeast, they're having problems with losses of what are called base cations, things like calcium. And so now calcium is a limiting nutrient in those forests, and it's changing the plant's physiological responses to their environment. It hasn't been going on long enough to really change community composition outside of, there are all sorts of other things going on too, like harvesting and stuff like that. So carbon is also changing, and we'll talk about that in this class too. I'm going to talk about the case study assignment first, because it has to do with the carbon cycle and global change. It requires you to use Microsoft Excel. Has anybody never not used Microsoft Excel? Okay. If you have problems running it, you can make an appointment and come. We can use a computer in my lab or something. So if you go to the case studies section, you'll see this case study number 4, the Excel spreadsheet. And what that spreadsheet will do is it allows you to calculate your ecological footprint. And the kind of conceptualization behind the ecological footprint is saying, okay, how much ecologically productive land, so not like a parking lot, but a nice piece of land that grows grass or something. How much productive land is required to maintain a particular lifestyle? And in terms of the available land globally, there is about 2 hectares or 4.5 acres available per person given today's population size. Actually, it's probably a little bit less. Globally, the average footprint of humans is 2.3 hectares. And people in the United States have a footprint of 9.6 hectares. And so what this calculator does is it says, okay, well, what types of resources do you use on a monthly basis? So taking into account things like food, how much water you consume, where your food comes from. Are you buying produce, for example, that's out of season and being shipped from Chile to your dinner table? Or do you grow your own food? Do you live on a farm? That decreases your footprint considerably if you're growing your own food. If you're eating meat every day, that increases your footprint by a lot. And if you travel a lot in cars or airplanes, that contributes a lot. So what I want you to do is look over this spreadsheet and find out what kind of data you need. You need to kind of, over the next week, monitor how much food you're eating and where it's coming from, and scale that to a whole month. So if you buy a pound of bananas on average each week, multiply that by four to get how many you consume in a month. Look at your last electric and gas bills, and you'll have to put that kilowatt hours of energy that you use. If you live in a dorm, it would be really fun to call the school's housing office and talk to them about this. Usually they don't have any idea how much electricity a dorm room would use, but if you want to get into a little debate with them, it's kind of fun. I called Logan City last year to find out where our electricity comes from. Previously, I don't know if you heard in the news over the last couple weeks, but the city voted to not purchase as much coal-generated electricity. So before, they were buying 90% of their power from the coal-burning plant in Delta, and now they have voted to go with geothermal electricity, which over the short term is going to be more expensive, but over the long term is probably going to end up being cheaper. I don't know if you heard in the last couple of weeks, the Supreme Court ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency has to regulate CO2 emissions. And so what that means is that things like fossil fuel burning electrical plants, like coal burn plants, will have to have a carbon tax paid. And so if they do that, then that'll increase the cost of electricity that's generated from coal. So Logan City is trying to minimize that in the long term by going with geothermal electricity.
From where?
I can't remember where. So the first part of this thing, the way that this works is it's easier, I think, to use United States units instead of the metric system, but if you want to use the metric system, you can. So you enter an S for standard up in this blue box right there. And then it'll ask you, how many pounds of vegetables do you eat in a month? So in everything that's blue, it's asking you to put some form of data here. How many people live in your house? If you have a lot of kids, it decreases your ecological footprint in some ways. Yes, and that's one of the criticisms of this type of calculator, is because it's calculating a household footprint. And so if you have, say, four kids, then you'll divide your household footprint by six. So, yeah.
So would that, so if you have roommates, would you just divide it by however many
roommates? Yeah, so divide it by however many roommates you have. So the first part is, how much food do you buy or eat? How big is your house?
I have a question.
Yeah.
We're going to be doing the food and our habits by ourselves, but the electricity and whatever else, water consumption by the household. So how does that factor
Well, so what you would have to do is say if your household has four roommates and you would divide your electrical bill by four and just enter that part. Same deal with the size of the house.
So then you would only put one person as the household.
Yeah. Unless you wanted to do it for your whole household.
Then you'd have to figure out their
right. Yeah.
And they figured out available land to get this hectares per person availability. Did they consider that only habitable, farmable land? They include the house and stuff like that?
They do not include land that's covered with ice or land. It's got to be land that can grow food, basically. Grow plants. So all of the areas that have been desertified or changed over to desert, those are not considered productive land. Parking lots are not considered productive land. So it asks you how much you spend on hotels and motels a year or a month. How much gas do you use? How much water do you use? How much firewood do you use? Computers add a lot to your ecological footprint. Then it asks you about transportation and amount per month. The hard one, I think, for a lot of people to quantify is what kinds of goods do you use on a monthly basis? So for example, clothes. If you buy used clothes, so what you need to do is just kind of think, do I buy a new shirt every month? And how much does that weigh? It weighs about a pound. So kind of think about how often you buy new clothes and just guesstimate that. How many books do you buy a month? That kind of thing. Yeah. Right, if you're using the glass, but I mean, at some point you would have had to purchase a glass. The interesting thing, if you look on these little red triangles, it tells you the average U.S. consumption of stuff like that. So if you, like for glass, it's 3 pounds per month. And I'm assuming here that they're talking about glass bottles for a lot of that. They used to have things like furniture on here, and I don't see that anymore. But, for example, if you had an antique piece of furniture, you could say, well, it was 500 pounds, but it's 100 years old. So that's like a half a pound a month or something like that. So you have to kind of fiddle around with those particular things. It does account, so his question is, does it take into account if you're buying turkey from Sweet Peas versus buying turkey from Tyson Foods? A lot of it is local. It doesn't have anything about organic food or things like that. It does have, well here, I mean if you're buying organic food, I would say put most of the food is locally grown and not processed. And so that changes it a little bit. How much waste do you have every month? That kind of thing. So, yeah, Evan.
Do you buy a glass bottle and throw it away and count it both
times? No. The glass that you put here would be stuff that you're keeping.
Oh,
okay. Okay. It also has a thing where if you're recycling stuff, you can enter that too. So, I mean, this certainly has a lot of assumptions in it, and the goal here is just to get you to think about this. You're welcome to work in groups to fill out the spreadsheet so that you can talk about what factors might be causing the size of your footprint to be what it is.
Is that printable?
Yeah, you can print it, but in order to do the calculations, you have to enter the numbers there. Don't change the equations. If you change the equations, then it'll mess up your results. So then at the bottom, it'll give you your footprint in hectares, which is in metric units, and that's useful for comparing to other countries that are calculating these kinds of things. And then it'll tell you how much it is in acres also. So what you can also do if you're trying to figure out, well, what in my footprint is causing it to be a particular size, you can go in and change the numbers and say, well, if I change my driving to less per week or per month, then what will that do? Or if I decide to go on I'm graduating from college and I'm going to go on a round-the-world trip traveling, how much is that going to add to my ecological footprint? My footprint is 7 hectares, which is pretty big.
It says the average American is 9.6.
Yeah.
I bet you mine's 20. It's going to be ugly.
Does yours take into effect your job, all the research and stuff that you do?
Yeah, so the biggest part of my ecological footprint is travel to field sites and travel in airplanes. Like, I had to go to Washington, D.C. last week, so that added to my footprint. My husband works in Salt Lake City, so his footprint is like 20 because he's driving to Salt Lake City every day. Mm-hmm. So on average, we're, as a household, we're probably a little bit above the U.S. average. Huh? So if you have problems as you're going through this, we can do it in my office or something like that.
Who made that spreadsheet? Did you come up with that? Or is that like
no. There's a website that's listed on here called redefiningprogress.org that you can download that from, and they have a lot of research articles about this, and they talk about some of the assumptions that are behind the calculations. People have been starting to use it to evaluate ecological footprints of cities. So, for example, some scientists in Phoenix that are associated with an ecological research center there calculated the water footprint for Phoenix. And, I mean, it covers half of Utah and part of California and stuff like that. So it's being used as a way of evaluating resource consumption, basically.
Ecologists are doing this kind of work. Let's look at what we call progress, you know, job creation, real estate usage, and that kind of thing, in a totally different sense than what the capitalists do.
His point was ecologists probably look at progress in a different way than, say, a real estate type person or business person would. And you're right, there is some conflict there. Yeah, that's very different direction. And that's why on that thing of what's a frontier in ecology at this scale is trying to put value on things like biodiversity. How can you put that in terms of dollars? And how much would it cost if we lost species versus saved land for species and that type of thing? So putting dollars on these kinds of things is a big area right now. So this ecological footprint deals with how much productive land there is, and quantifying primary production is a big deal in ecosystem ecology. So what I want to do now is talk about what primary productivity is and how you measure it, and then what might control rates of primary productivity. So first, what is primary productivity?
Well,
Right, it's the source. Of energy. For the organisms that live in ecosystems. The ultimate source, though, is obviously going to be the sun. Or inorganic chemicals. But primary production is the rate of transfer of energy into biomass at the lowest trophic level. So it's important because the rate of primary production is going to control the amount of energy that's available for all the other biota that live in that ecosystem. So that's why it's important. And some terminology associated with it is biomass. Biomass can be quantified in a variety of ways, but basically it's the a weight or a mass of organisms. It can be done on wet weight. So if you wanted to know the biomass of fishes in a lake, you would electroshock or seine and collect fish of different sizes and weigh them while they're wet. It can be dry weight. So you could take clippings of grass and dry them up and then weigh how much grass biomass there was that way. In terms of primary production, there's two aspects to it. Gross primary production, or GPP, is the total rate of photosynthesis, say, in a terrestrial environment. So it's the total energy in if we're talking about a forest ecosystem, it would be equivalent to the rate of photosynthesis. But we know that in order to grow and survive and reproduce, those trees in the forest are going to have to do some metabolic activities, and so they lose energy through respiration. So that's R, respiration. So that effectively is like a tax on the ecosystem that results in some net primary productivity. And the net primary productivity is the amount of energy that's actually going to be available to the next trophic level. So how is primary productivity measured? It depends on what kind of environment you're working in. And in some cases it's fairly simple, and others it's really challenging. So in aquatic environments, one proxy for production is to measure how much chlorophyll there is in the water. So chlorophyll, what's chlorophyll? Right, it's the green pigment that is used to capture light in photosynthesis. So it's basically measuring how much of that pigment is in the water. And that correlates with how much productivity there is. Another way of doing it would be to measure, yeah, John?
Is there any other form of primary productivity in photosynthesis?
Primary productivity in the deep sea hydrothermal vents would be that microbial production. So the chemosynthetic. Yeah. You can measure photosynthesis. What's the chemical equation for photosynthesis? So in an aquatic environment, we could do two things. We could measure, well, we could do a couple of different things. In lakes, what often people do is they will use radioactive carbon dioxide in a bottle and measure either the loss of carbon dioxide or the accumulation of carbon-14 in the algae to measure photosynthesis. Or measure the change in oxygen over time. Since oxygen is a product of photosynthesis during the day, in a lake you can measure an increase in oxygen and get photosynthetic rate that way. What's the chemical equation for respiration? It's the opposite. And to measure respiration, you basically would do a similar type of thing. You can add a radio-labeled or stable isotope-labeled carbon substrate and measure its accumulation in carbon dioxide. You can measure depletion of oxygen in the dark, so shut the lights off and figure out how much oxygen is consumed, or shut the lights off and measure how much carbon dioxide is produced. And so those are some simple ways that people in freshwater measure it. Terrestrial environments are much harder. Yeah, Shailen.
Well, I was just kind of curious, wouldn't that, in the photosynthesis way of measuring it, wouldn't you have to do that over an extremely long period of time because your environment is going to be changing daily?
Would you have to do it? Yeah. So one way that people do it, well, there are a couple of different ways. One is to do it in bottles. Like if you're in a lake, you could take water in bottles and put some bottles in the light and some in the dark. And the ones in the dark are going to consume oxygen. And the ones in the light are going to produce oxygen. So you can get them that way. Another way that people are doing it is by deploying these sensors that measure oxygen over whatever time interval you want. And they'll deploy them for weeks or months at a time. And you get a record where during the day you have oxygen going up, and then the lights go off, the sun goes down, so you get a record like this. And by knowing something about how much exchange there is with the atmosphere, you can calculate photosynthesis and respiration from that. Terrestrial environments are really hard because we don't have kind of a, like in an aquatic environment like a lake, you have this bowl of water that you can measure these chemical changes pretty easily. One way that terrestrial ecologists measure primary production is by using leaf-specific measures. So they have sensors that measure photosynthetic rates, basically stomatal conductance, or how much exchange there is across the stomata, and scaling that for a photosynthetic rate. Another way is by harvesting. So this would take a lot of time and effort. You go to a plot, say, of grassland monthly and collect a square meter of grass every month and measure how much biomass there was. But that's not including the below-ground biomass or the root biomass. So getting at that aspect of production is really difficult in terrestrial environments. And then remote sensing is becoming more and more commonly used in terrestrial and aquatic environments, and that's where they use satellites to basically quantify the chlorophyll on the land and correlate that with some measure of primary productivity. So at a large scale, kind of geographic scale, one of the primary controls of production is climate and terrestrial environments. Actual evapotranspiration is abbreviated as AET. For review, who can tell me what evapotranspiration is? It's a measure of evaporation and transpiration together. And what's transpiration? Flux of water through plants. And plants are doing that in order to acquire carbon dioxide and water. So actual evapotranspiration is the actual water flux. From a terrestrial environment.
Would that directly also affect humidity?
Pardon me?
Does that directly affect humidity in the air?
Does it directly affect humidity in the air? Yeah, it's a part of, when you have high evapotranspiration rates, you have high humidity. So actual evapotranspiration is going to be regulated to some extent by water availability. And you can see that environments like creosote desert have really low water availability and they have low rates of net primary production compared to a tropical forest. So these are a variety of biomes laid out on this gradient. You can see that moisture availability is going to be an important control. Here's just precipitation, and this is within grassland biomes and primary productivity. So you can see that even within a given biome, the amount of moisture available is important. So you get a positive relationship between primary productivity and rainfall. So again, water is important. Within a site, the available nutrients is going to be another control. So here is an experiment where they're studying primary production in tundra, so up in the polar region, and if you add fertilizer, you double the rate of primary production, which makes sense. That's why we use it to grow food. Here they're examining what type of nutrient is more important for controlling primary productivity. And so here they're just measuring the above ground biomass in the tundra in a dry environment versus a wet environment. First off, in the controls, you can see that water is going to be an important control on primary productivity. Here, the control has about 120 grams of biomass per square meter, and it's more than double in the wet meadow. So water there is, again, important. But by adding either phosphorus alone, nitrogen alone, or nitrogen and phosphorus together, you can get a sense of which nutrient is more limiting to plant growth. Here, there's not really a difference between the control and the phosphorus, so phosphorus isn't really controlling that plant growth. Nitrogen does. And when you add them both together, you get some more growth. In the wet meadow, there's no difference between phosphorus and nitrogen, so that meadow is limited by both nitrogen and phosphorus, so when you add them both, you get a big increase. So nutrients are important. In most terrestrial environments, the thought is that nitrogen is limiting plant growth. In freshwater ecosystems, the dogma has been that phosphorus limits the growth of algae. So here's a graph that shows chlorophyll concentration versus the concentration of phosphorus. And you see there's a nice positive relationship here. And experimentally, here's a lake where they're comparing two lakes. One's a control. Here's how much algal biomass there is. And then they added phosphorus fertilizer. And you can see it went up considerably. And through this fertilization experiment, so this is one lake that they added phosphorus fertilizer to. In the 1970s, people were concerned that there was a lot of phosphorus effluent from soaps and other surfactants, other cleaning agents had a lot of phosphorus in them. And they would get, you know, really high concentrations of algae when there was a lot of phosphorus around. So phosphorus was limiting the algae growth. But they were getting really obnoxiously green lakes and a lot of pollution. So the Clean Water Act was implemented in 1972, and one of the things that was made illegal was to have phosphorus in detergents. And so that helped to decrease the eutrophication associated with phosphorus. In the western United States, our geology tends to have more phosphorus-rich rocks from volcanic types of rock. And so in a lot of the aquatic systems of the western United States, they're nitrogen limited, not phosphorus limited. In the oceans are primarily nitrogen limited. And this is a cartoon that's coming from a satellite image that's showing how much chlorophyll is in the oceans. And you can see along the coast, there's a lot of chlorophyll. And the thought is that you've got nitrogen coming in from rivers and stuff that are stimulating that. Also areas of upwelling, bringing nitrogen up along the coast and the equator, tend to support more primary productivity that way. Here's an example of looking at the control of primary productivity in the Baltic Sea by nitrate. And what they did is they did some bottle experiments on board the ship from these different locations in the Baltic Sea, so right north of Poland. And they had control, added phosphorus, and added nitrogen. And you can see that nitrogen is stimulating primary productivity in that seawater. Phosphorus doesn't really do anything. There is another hypothesis, though, about what controls primary productivity in the oceans, and that comes from areas like this in the South Pacific that have high amounts of nitrogen but low concentrations of chlorophyll. And the hypothesis is called the Geritol hypothesis. And you guys are probably too young to know what Geritol is. Does anybody know what Geritol is? It's a multivitamin that's marketed to older people that has a lot of iron in it. And so the idea here in the Geritol hypothesis is that iron limits productivity in the oceans. And there's been considerable amount of work that has examined the role of iron as a limiting nutrient in the oceans. And part of the reason for a lot of this work has to do with whether or not the ocean can be used to ameliorate the carbon dioxide increases that have been going on in the atmosphere. And basically the idea is, can we stimulate the biological pump? Can we stimulate phytoplankton in the ocean to suck up more CO2? So the biological pump is these algae take up CO2, and of course they support the food web, but some of them sink to the bottom of the ocean where there's no mixing, and so that carbon will reside there for a long time. So if we can get these guys to grow faster, can we suck up some CO2? And one idea is behind this Geroldtrawl hypothesis, and there's an oceanographer named John Martin who said in a scientific meeting with like 10,000 people, said before everybody, give me a half a tank of iron and I'll give you the next ice age. And so he stimulated a lot of research to figure out whether or not iron limits primary productivity in the ocean. And they did a bunch of experiments. The first one was in 1993, where they dumped about 450 kilograms of iron in a part of the ocean in the South Pacific over 64 square miles. So they just basically pumped out some iron in their ballast water, and they measured an algal bloom in response to that. Then there was another one off the Galapagos Islands where they injected iron and saw a 30-fold increase in phytoplankton that was equivalent to the biomass of 100 old-growth redwood trees, and pulled a lot of carbon, 2,500 tons of carbon, out of the water. So that looks promising, right? Here's another one where the tanker was floating around. This is several hundred kilometers, and they dumped out a bunch of iron and produced that algal bloom that could be observed from space using satellites. And so sure, they can stimulate primary productivity, but is this stimulation going to result in a net sequestration or a net uptake of carbon over a long period of time? In order to understand that, they had to do these experiments, but then measure how much of the algae were sinking below the top part of the ocean. If they're up above the thermocline, then they're going to be cycled back to the atmosphere eventually. If they go below the thermocline, they can stay there for about 1,000 years. So they then tracked it through these particle traps to figure out how much actually sank. And in the lab, they were thinking they would sink 100,000 tons of carbon, and they were off by two orders of magnitude. So it's not going to be a very effective tool to ameliorate the CO2 going into the atmosphere at this point. There's a guy who is he patented some process of adding iron to the oceans and bought some fishing rights off the Marshall Islands and said, oh, I'm going to start doing this in a carbon training type of thing. But data like this that say not very much is going to sink means that he probably won't be very effective. John? Yeah, and some of the effect of these iron experiments is that they stimulate taxa that are not palatable to the fish and that actually might have some toxins. So we'll stop here and then come back to this on Tuesday.